Putting her arms around both Laura and China, guiding them to the broad flight of porch steps, Sarah said, "We'll get your luggage later. Dinner's ready now. Come along. Laura's told me so much about you, China." "Well, Mom," said Laura, "I didn't tell you about China being into voodoo. I sort of hid that part. She'll need to sacrifice a live chicken every night at midnight while she's staying with us." "We only grow grapes. We don't have any chickens, dear," Sarah said. "But after dinner, we can drive to one of the farms in the area and buy a few." China laughed and looked at Laura as if to say, "Where's the infamous look?" Laura understood. "In your honor, China, all wire coat hangers and equivalent devices have been put away."
"Whatever are you talking about?" Sarah asked.
"You know me, Mom, a babbling ditz. Sometimes not even I know what I'm talking about." Paul Templeton, Laura's father, was in the big kitchen, taking a potato and cheese casserole out of the oven. He was a neat, compact man, 5'10", with thick, dark hair and a ruddy complexion. He set the steaming dish aside, stripped off a pair of oven mitts, and greeted Laura as warmly as Sarah had done. After being introduced to China, he took one of her hands in both of his, which were rough and work-worn, and with feigned solemnity he said, "We prayed you'd make the trip in one piece. Does my little girl still handle that Mustang as if she thinks it's the Batmobile?"
"Hey, Dad," Laura said, "I guess you've forgotten who taught me to drive."
"I was instructing you in the basic techniques," Paul said. "I didn't expect you to acquire my style."
Sarah said, "I refuse to think about Laura's driving. I'd just be worried sick all the time." "Face it, Mom, there's an Indianapolis 500 gene on Dad's side of the family, and he passed it to me." "She's an excellent driver," China said. "I always feel safe with Laura."
Laura grinned at her and gave a thumbs-up sign.
Dinner was a long, leisurely affair because the Templetons liked to talk to one another, thrived on talking to one another. They were careful to include China and seemed genuinely interested in what she had to say, but even when the conversation wandered to family matters of which China had little knowledge, she somehow felt a part of it, as though she was, by a magical osmosis, actually being absorbed into the Templeton clan. Laura's 30-ish brother Jack and his wife Nina lived in the caretaker's bungalow elsewhere in the vineyard, but a previous obligation had prevented them from joining the family for dinner. China was assured that she would see them in the morning, and she felt no trepidation about meeting them as she'd felt before she'd met Sarah and Paul. Throughout her troubled life, there had been no place where she had truly felt at home. While she might never feel entirely at home in this place either, at least she felt welcome here. After dinner, China and Laura went for a walk in the moonlit vineyards, between the rows of low-pruned vines that had not yet begun to sprout either leafy trailers or fruit. The cool air was redolent with a pleasant fecund smell of freshly plowed earth, and there was a sense of mystery in the dark fields that she found intriguing, enchanting, but at times disconcerting, as if they were among unseen presences, ancient spirits that were not all benign. When they had strolled deep into the vines and then turned back toward the house, China said, "You're the best friend I've ever had."
"Me too," Laura said.
"More than that." China's voice trailed away. She had been about to say, "You're the only friend I've ever had," but that made her seem so lame and, besides, was still an inadequate expression of what she felt for this girl. They were, indeed, in one sense, sisters. Laura linked arms with her and merely said,
"I know.
When you have babies, I want them to call me Aunt China."
"Listen, Shepard, don't you think I should find a guy and get married before I start pumping out the babies?"
"Whoever he is, he better be the best husband in the world to you, or I promise I'll cut his cojones off."
"Do me a favor, okay?" Laura said. "Don't tell him about this promise until after the wedding. Some guys might be put off by it."
From elsewhere in the vineyards came a disquieting sound that stopped China, a protracted creaking.
"It's just the breeze working at a loose barn door. Rusty hinges," Laura said.
It sounded as if someone were opening a giant door in the wall of night itself and stepping in from another world. China Shepherd could not sleep comfortably in strange houses. Throughout her childhood and adolescence, her mother had dragged her from one end of the country to the other, staying nowhere longer than a month or two. So many terrible things had happened to them in so many places, that China eventually learned to view each new house not as a new beginning, not with hope for stability and happiness, but with suspicion and quiet dread. Now she was long rid of her troubled mother, and free to stay only where she wished. These days her life was almost as stable as that of a cloistered nun, as meticulously planned as any bomb squad's procedures for disarming an explosive device, and without any of the turmoil on which her mother had thrived. Nevertheless, this first night in the Templetons' house, China was reluctant to undress and go to bed. She sat in the darkness, in a medallion-back armchair at one of the two windows in the guest room, gazing out at the moonlit vineyards, fields, and hills of the Napa Valley. Laura was in another room, at the far end of the second-floor hall, no doubt sound asleep, at peace because this house was not at all strange to her. From the guest room window, the early spring vineyards were barely visible, vague, geometric patterns. Beyond the cultivated rows were gentle hills mantled in long, dry grass, silver in the moonlight. An inconstant breeze stirred through the valley, and sometimes the wild grass seemed to roll like ocean waves across the slopes, softly aglimmer with lambent lunar light. Above the hills were the coast ranges, and above those peaks were cascades of stars and a full white moon. Storm clouds coming across the mountains from the northwest would soon darken the night, turning the silver hills first to pewter and then to blackest iron. When she heard the first scream, China was gazing at the stars, drawn by their cold light as she had been since childhood, fascinated by the thought of distant worlds that might be barren and clean, free of pestilence. At first, the muffled cry seemed to be only a memory, a fragment of a shrill argument from another strange house in the past, echoing across time. Often, as a child, eager to hide from her mother and her mother's friends when they were drunk or high, she climbed onto porch roofs or into backyard trees, slipped through windows onto fire escapes, away to secret places far from the fray, where she could study the stars and where voices raised in argument or sexual excitement or shrill, drug-induced giddiness came to her as though from out of a radio, from faraway places and people who had no connection whatsoever with her life. The second cry, though also brief and only slightly louder than the first, was indisputably of the moment, not a memory, and China sat forward on her chair, tense, head cocked, listening. She wanted to believe that the voice had come from outside, so she continued to stare into the night, surveying the vineyards and the hills beyond. Breeze-driven waves swelled through the dry grass on the moon-washed slopes, a water mirage like the ghost tides of an ancient sea. From elsewhere in the large house came a soft thump, as though a heavy object had fallen to a carpeted floor. China immediately rose from the chair and stood utterly still, expectant. Trouble often followed voices raised in one kind of passion or another. Sometimes, however, the worst offenses were preceded by calculated silences and stealth. She had difficulty reconciling the idea of domestic violence with Paul and Sarah Templeton, who had seemed kind and loving toward each other as toward their daughter. Nevertheless, appearances and realities were seldom the same, and the human talent for deception was far greater than that of the chameleon, the mockingbird, or the praying mantis that masked its ferocious cannibalism with a serene and devout posture. Following the stifled cries and the soft thump, silence sifted down like a snowfall. The hush was eerily deep, as unnatural as that in which the deaf lived. This was the stillness before the pounce, the quietude of the coiled snake. In another part of the house, someone was standing as motionless as she herself was standing, as alert as she was, intently listening. Someone dangerous. She could sense the predatory presence, a subtle new pressure in the air not dissimilar to that preceding a violent thunderstorm. On one level, 6 years of psychology classes caused her to question her immediate fearful interpretation of those night sounds, which conceivably could be insignificant, after all. Any well-trained psychoanalyst would have a wealth of labels to pin on someone who leaped first to a negative conclusion, who lived in expectation of sudden violence. But she had to trust her instinct. It had been honed by many years of hard experience. Intuitively certain that safety lay in movement, She stepped quietly away from the chair at the window toward the hall door. In spite of the moon glow, her eyes had adjusted to darkness during the 2 hours that she had sat in the lightless room, and now she eased through the gloom with no fear of blundering into furniture. She was only halfway to the door when she heard approaching footsteps in the second-floor hall. The heavy, urgent tread was alien to this house. Unhampered by the interminable second-guessing that accompanied an education in psychology, reverting to the intuition and defenses of childhood, China quickly retreated to the bed. She dropped to her knees. Farther along the hall, the footsteps stopped. A door opened. She was aware of the absurdity of attributing rage to the mere opening of a door, the rattle of the knob being turned, the rasp of the unsecured latch, the spike-sharp squeak of an unoiled hinge. They were only sounds, neither meek nor furious, guilty nor innocent, and could have been made as easily by a priest as by a burglar. Yet she knew that rage was at work in the night. Flat on her stomach, she wriggled under the bed, feet toward the headboard. It was a graceful piece of furniture with sturdy galb legs, and fortunately it didn't sit as close to the floor as did most beds. 1 inch less of clearance would have prevented her from hiding under it. Footsteps sounded in the hall again. Another door opened, the guest room door, directly opposite the foot of the bed. Someone switched on the lights. China lay with her head turned to one side, her right ear pressed to the carpet. Staring out from under the footboard, she could see a man's black boots and the legs of his blue jeans below mid-calf. He stood just inside the threshold, evidently surveying the room. He would see a bed still neatly made at 1 o'clock in the morning, with 4 decorative needlepoint pillows arranged against the headboard. She had nothing left on the nightstands, no clothes tossed on chairs. The paperback novel that she had brought with her for bedtime reading was in a bureau drawer. She preferred spaces that were clean and uncluttered to the point of monastic sterility. Her preference might now save her life. Again, a faint doubt, the acquired propensity for self-analysis that plagued all psychology students, flickered through her. If the man in the doorway was someone with a right to be in the house, Paul Templeton or Laura's brother Jack, who lived with his wife in the vineyard manager's bungalow elsewhere on the property, and if some crisis was unfolding that explained why he would burst into her room without knocking, she was going to appear to be a prime fool, if not a hysteric, when she crawled out from under the bed. Then directly in front of the black boots, a fat red droplet, another, and a third, fell to the wheat-gold carpet. Plop. Plop, plop. Blood. The first 2 soaked into the thick nylon pile. The third held its surface tension, shimmering like a ruby. China knew that the blood wasn't that of the intruder. She tried not to think about the sharp instrument from which it might have fallen. He moved off to her right, deeper into the room, and she rolled her eyes to follow him. The bed had carved side rails into which the spread was tightly tucked. No overhanging fabric obstructed her view of his boots. Obversely, without a spread draped to the floor, the space under the bed was more visible to him. From certain angles he might even be able to look down and see a swatch of her blue jeans, the toe of one of her rockports, the cranberry red sleeve of her cotton sweater where it stretched over her bent elbow. She was thankful that the bed was queen size, offering more cover than a single or double. If he was breathing hard, either with excitement or with the rage that she had sensed in his approach, China couldn't hear him. With 1 ear pressed tightly to the plush carpet, she was half deaf. Wood slats and box springs weighed on her back, and her chest barely had room to expand to accommodate her own shallow, cautious, open-mouth inhalations. The hammering of her compressed heart against her breastbone echoed tympanically within her, and it seemed to fill the claustrophobic confines of her hiding place to such an extent that the intruder was certain to hear. He went to the bathroom, pushed open the door, and flicked on the lights. She had put away her toiletries in the medicine cabinet, even her toothbrush. Nothing lay out that might alert him to her presence. But was the sink dry? On retiring to her room at 11 o'clock, she had used the toilet and then had washed her hands. That was 2 hours ago. Any residual water in the bowl surely would have drained away or evaporated. Lemon-scented liquid soap in a pump dispenser was provided at the sink. Fortunately, there was no damp bar of soap to betray her. She worried about the hand towel. She doubted that it could still be damp 2 hours after the little use that she had made of it. Nonetheless, in spite of a propensity for neatness and order, she might have left it hanging ever so slightly askew or with one telltale wrinkle. He seemed to stand on the bathroom threshold for an eternity. Then he switched off the fluorescent light and returned to the bedroom. Occasionally, as a little girl, and then not so little, China had taken refuge under beds. Sometimes they looked for her there. Sometimes, though it was the most obvious of all hidey holes, they never thought to look. Of those who found her, a few had checked under the bed first, but most had left it for last. Another red droplet fell to the carpet, as though the beast might be shedding slow tears of blood. He moved toward the closet door. China had to turn her head slightly, straining her neck to keep track of him. The closet was deep, a walk-in with a chain-pull light in the center. She heard the distinctive snap of the tugged switch, then the clinking of the metal beads in the chain as they rattled against the light bulb. The Templetons stored their own luggage at the back of that closet. Stacked with the other suitcases, China's single bag and train case were not obviously those of a guest in residence. She had brought several changes of clothes, 2 dresses, 2 skirts, another pair of jeans, a pair of chinos, a leather jacket. Because China was the same size as Laura, the intruder might conclude that the few garments on the rod were just spillovers from the packed closet in Laura's room, rather than evidence of a house guest. If he had been in Laura's bedroom, however, and had seen the condition of her closet, then what had happened to Laura? She must not think about that. Not now. Not yet. For the moment, she needed to focus all her thoughts, all of her wits, on staying alive. 18 years ago, on the night of her 8th birthday, in a seaside cottage on Key West, China had squirmed under her bed to hide from Jim Waltz, her mother's friend. A storm had been raging from the Gulf of Mexico, and the sky-blistering lightning had made her fearful of escaping to the sanctuary of the beach, where she'd retreated on other nights. After committing herself to the cramped space under that iron bed, which had been lower slung than this one, she had discovered that she was sharing it with a palmetto beetle. Palmettos were not as exotic or as pretty as their name. In fact, they were nothing more than enormous tropical cockroaches. This one had been as large as her little girl hand. Ordinarily, the hateful bug would have scurried away from her, but it had seemed less alarmed by her than by the thundering Waltz, who had crashed around her small room in a drunken fury, rebounding tirelessly from the furniture and the walls, like an enraged animal throwing itself against the bars of its cage. China had been barefoot, dressed in blue shorts and a white tube top, and the palmetto beetle had raced in a frenzy over all that exposed skin, between her toes, up and down her legs and up again, across her back, along her neck, into her hair, over her shoulder, the length of her slender arm. She hadn't dared to squeal in revulsion, afraid of drawing Waltz's attention. He had been wild that night, like a monster from a dream, and she had been convinced that, like all monsters, he possessed supernaturally keen sight and hearing, the better to hunt children. She hadn't even found the courage to strike out at the beetle or knock it away, for fear that Waltz would hear the smallest sound even over the shriek of the storm and the incessant crashing of thunder. She had endured the palmetto's attentions in order to avoid those of Waltz, clenching her teeth to bite off a scream, praying desperately for God to save her, then praying harder for God to take her, praying for an end to the torment, even if by a bolt of lightning, an end to the torment, an end, dear God, an end. Now, although she wasn't sharing the space under this galb-leg bed with any cockroach, China could feel one crawling over her toes as if she were that barefoot girl again, scurrying up her legs as if she were wearing not jeans but cotton shorts. She had never again worn her hair long since the night of her 8th birthday, when the bug had burrowed through her tresses, but now she felt the ghost of that palmetto in her closely cropped hair. The man in the closet, perhaps capable of atrocities far worse than the wickedest dreams and desires of Waltz, tugged on the chain pull. The light went out with a click, followed by a tinkle of metal beads. The booted feet reappeared and approached the bed. A fresh tear of blood glistened on the curve of black leather. He was going to drop to one knee beside the bed. Dear God, he'll find me cowering like a child, choking on my own stifled scream in a cold sweat, all dignity lost in the desperate struggle to stay alive, untouched and alive, untouched and alive.
She had the crazy feeling that when he peered under the side rail face to face with her, he would not be a man, but an enormous palmetto with multifaceted black eyes. She had been reduced to the helplessness of childhood, to the primal fear that she had hoped never to know again. He had stolen from her the self-respect that she had earned from years of endurance, that she had earned, God damn him, and the injustice of it filled her eyes with bitter tears. But then his blurred boots turned away from her and kept moving. He walked past the bed to the open door. Whatever he thought about the clothes hanging in the closet, apparently he had not inferred from them that the guest room was occupied. She blinked furiously, clearing her tear-blurred vision. He stopped and turned, evidently studying the bedroom one last time. Lest he hear her child's shallow exhalations, China held her breath. She was glad that she wore no perfume. She was certain that he would have smelled her. He switched off the light, stepped into the hall, and pulled the door shut as he went. His footsteps moved off the way he had come, for her room was the last on the second floor. His tread swiftly faded, cloaked by the fierce pounding of her heart. Her first inclination was to remain in that narrow haven between the carpet and the box springs, wait until daybreak or even longer, wait until there came a long silence that ceased to seem like the stillness of a crouched predator. But she didn't know what had happened to Laura, Paul, or Sarah. Any of them, all of them, might be alive, grievously wounded, but drawing breath. The intruder might even be keeping them alive to torture them at his leisure. Any newspaper regularly reported stories of cruelty no worse than the possible scenarios that now unreeled vividly in her mind. And if any of the Templetons still lived, China might be their only hope of survival. She had crawled out of all the many hideaways of her childhood with less fear than she felt when she hesitantly slid out from under this bed. Of course, she had more to lose now than before she had walked out on her mother 10 years ago, a decent life built on a decade of ceaseless struggle and hard-won self-respect. It seemed madness to take this risk when safety was assured simply by staying put, but personal safety at the expense of others was cowardice, and cowardice was a right only of small children who lacked the strength and experience to defend themselves. She couldn't simply retreat into the defensive detachment of her childhood. Doing so would mean the end of all self-respect. Slow-motion suicide. It's not possible to retreat into a bottomless pit. One can only plunge. In the open once more, she rose into a crouch beside the bed. She was frozen by the expectation that the door would crash open and that the intruder would burst in again. The house was as echo-free as any airless moon. China rose to her feet and silently crossed the dark guest room. Unable to see the trio of blood drops, she tried to step around the place where they had fallen earlier. She pressed her left ear to the crack between the door and the jamb, listening for movement or breathing in the hall. She heard nothing, yet she remained suspicious. He could be on the other side of the door, smiling, deeply amused to think that she was listening, biding his time, patient because he knew that eventually she would open the door and step into his arms. Screw it. She put her hand on the knob, turned it cautiously, and winced as the spring latch scraped softly out of its notch. At least the hinges were lubricated and silent. Even in the inkiness to which her vision had not totally readapted, she could see that no one was waiting for her. She stepped out of her room and soundlessly pulled the door shut. The guest quarters were off the shorter arm of the L-shaped upstairs hall. To her right were the back stairs which led down to the kitchen. To her left lay the turn into the longer arm of the L. She ruled out the back stairs. She had descended them earlier in the evening, when she and Laura went out to walk the vineyards. They were wooden and worn. They creaked and popped. The stairwell acted as an amplifier, as hollow and efficient as a steel drum. With the house so preternaturally silent, it would be impossible to creep down the back stairs undetected. The second-floor hall and the front stairs, on the other hand, were plushly carpeted. From around the corner, somewhere along the main hallway, came a soft amber glow. In the wallpaper, the delicate pattern of faded roses appeared to absorb the light rather than reflect it, acquiring an enigmatic depth that it had not previously possessed.
If the intruder had been standing anywhere between the junction of the hallways and the source of the light, he would have cast a distorted shadow across that luminous paper garden or on the wheat-gold carpet. There was no shadow. Keeping her back close to the wall, China edged to the corner, hesitated, and leaned out to scout the way ahead. The main hallway was deserted. Two sources of faint amber light relieved the gloom. The first came from a half-open door on the right, Paul and Sarah's suite. The second was much farther down the hallway, past the front stairs, on the left, Laura's room. The other doors all seemed to be closed. She didn't know what lay beyond them. Perhaps other bedrooms, a bath, an upstairs study, closets. Although China was most drawn to, and most afraid of, the lighted rooms, every closed door was also a danger. The unplumbable silence tempted her to believe that the intruder had gone. This was a temptation best resisted. Forward, then, through the paper arbor of printed roses, to the half-open door of the master suite, hesitating there, on the brink. When she found whatever waited to be found, all her illusions of order and stability might dissolve. The truth of life might then reassert itself, after 10 years during which she had diligently denied it. Chaos, like the flow of a stream of mercury, its course unpredictable from one moment to the next. The man in the blue jeans and black boots might have returned to the master suite after leaving the guest room, but more likely not. Other amusements in the house would no doubt be more appealing to him. Fearful of lingering too long in the hall, she sidled across the threshold without pushing the door open wider. Paul and Sarah's room was spacious. A sitting area included a pair of armchairs and footstools facing a fireplace. Bookshelves crammed with hardcovers flanked the mantel, their titles lost in shadows. The nightstand lamps were colorfully patterned ginger jars with pleated shades. One of them was aglow, crimson streaks and blots stained its shade. China stopped well short of the foot of the bed, already close enough to see too much. Neither Paul nor Sarah was there, but the sheets and blankets were in tangled disarray, trailing onto the floor on the right side of the bed. On the left, the linens were soaked with blood, and a wet spray glistened on the headboard and in an arc across the wall. She closed her eyes, heard something, spun around, crouching in expectation of an assault. She was alone. The noise had always been there, a background hiss, patter, splash of falling water. She hadn't heard it on entering the room, because she had been deafened by bloodstains as loud as the angry shouting of a maddened mob. Synesthesia. The word had stuck with her from a psychology text, more because she thought it was a beautiful arrangement of syllables than because she expected ever to experience it herself. Synesthesia, a confusion of the senses in which a scent might register as a flash of color, a sound actually might be perceived as a scent, and the texture of a surface under the hand might seem to be a trilling laugh or a scream. Closing her eyes had blocked out the roar of the bloodstains, whereupon she had heard the falling water. Now she recognized it as the sound of the shower in the adjoining bathroom. That door was ajar half an inch. For the first time since she had entered from the hallway, China noticed the thin band of fluorescent light along the bathroom jamb. When she looked away from that door, reluctant to confront what might wait beyond it, she spotted the telephone on the right-hand nightstand. That was the side of the bed without blood, which made it more approachable for her. She lifted the handset from the cradle. No dial tone. She had not expected to hear one. Nothing was ever that easy. She opened the single drawer on the nightstand, hoping to find a handgun. No luck. Still certain that her only hope of safety lay in movement, that crawling into a hole and hiding should always be the strategy of last resort, China had gone around to the other side of the king-size bed before she quite realized that she had taken a first step. In front of the bathroom door, the carpet was badly stained.